Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com.
Welcome to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Today on the program, Ingham County Register of Deeds Curtis Hertel Jr., who's been a bulldog on mortgage fraud and foreclosure issues, and Curtis will open up on the $2.5 million settlement announced last week for the state of Michigan that found in our favor. That's money from DocX, a robo-signing culprit. And what intrigues me most about this is that of the 1,000 robo-signing incidents that were a part of this lawsuit that was brought by Attorney General Bill Schuette, fully 300 of the 1,000 were from Ingham County. So we will get that explained to us by a guy right at the forefront of that, our Register of Deeds for Ingham County, Curtis Hertel Jr. That opens up our second half. East Lansing graphic designer, MSU prof Carl Goode on his years at Newsweek magazine on the way. And Scott Pohl's got a story about a new play being performed here in East Lansing about the UP. Always a rich topic for the stage and screen. If Shakespeare were alive, he would write a play about the UP. You know he would. It's just too rich. Some residents of Lansing's Walnut neighborhood are irritated over the ongoing impasse with an important neighbor. A number of people living near NioWave, that's the high-tech particle acceleration company, have been waiting months to hear what the company makes of its requests to improve the area around a massive pole barn that went up last year. A number of residents feel the structure is a blot on the neighborhood. City Councilman Brian Jeffries and several of his colleagues share the neighborhood's exasperation. He's part of an effort to resolve the situation as well as prevent similar breakdowns in the future. Current State also welcomes Walnut neighborhood resident Mary Elaine Keener for an update. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
And we regret that NioWave has declined to join us. We reached out multiple times to the company to join the conversation. They declined our initial offer and did not respond to our subsequent invitations to join us or to provide a statement. So we regret that, but we will charge ahead. I'm led to believe that they haven't been at the table for a while. Am I right, Mary Elaine?
That's correct.
Now, last December, you told the Lansing City Pulse that relations between the neighborhood and NioWave were at an all-time low. Those were your words. Has anything changed since then?
Nothing.
Okay. Now, you submitted a list of things that you wanted addressed related to the appearance of this pole barn. Remove all chain-link fencing around the property. Remove signs on the building and property. Eliminate the need for on-street employee parking. Plant mature trees on the site. And the list goes on. There's a number of things. Given the lack of response from NioWave, is your group considering settling for less, or are you as insistent as ever about getting all of these improvements?
We are as insistent as ever. To have all of those improvements and to have something done differently with the facade.
Okay, and let's clarify here. NioWave did put an offer on the table. Let's talk about that offer. What did they offer to do once you made this an issue?
They engaged Bob Ford, who is a landscape architect, and Bob put together a lovely landscaping plan.
Okay.
And it for what it was a lovely plan, but we were kind of being forced to just agree to it with no guarantees, with no accountability. And when I took it back to the neighbors over Thanksgiving in November, they just you know, they said the trees are bare. Even if we have mature trees, we're still going to have to look at the ugly building. Mm-hmm. And it's still impinging on the neighborhood. So that's when I went back to Niwave and said, I'm sorry, that's not enough.
So you're sticking with the seven or so. It's about seven. Asks, as you refer to them here, to try to get some relief here. And to be clear, is the neighborhood generally of one opinion about this?
The one opinion that is generally clear is that we do not want that building. We do not like having that building in the neighborhood, its impact on our property values and quality of life.
And it is a
14,000
square foot pole barn.
Okay. My 100-year-old three-story house could fit inside.
Okay. Is anything scheduled, really, right now? I know the City Council Planning and Development Committee meets tomorrow. Is anything scheduled? You're scheduled to address this tomorrow, correct, Brian?
We are. I mean, we've been talking about this issue since the mid part of last year. The first time that we found out about this in terms of it, council, was that we received a request from Niwave for a personal property exemption. They are in that building going to house about $5 million worth of equipment. And so they were looking for a tax abatement, personal property tax abatement, to the tune of about $230,000, $250,000. It was at that point that we were made aware that that building actually went up. I think if anyone goes over and looks at it, they're going to be saying, you know, what were they thinking? And it's not just Niwave that we should be talking about. We should go back a couple of years. How we got here was initially when Niwave came in to that neighborhood to create their business. They bought the Walnut Street School from the Lansing School District, and we worked with them, the city did, as well as the neighborhood, with incentives to get that business up and going. And it's been very successful, and they've been very good corporate citizens in that neighborhood in terms of not only the jobs that they brought, but they also invested in the neighborhood in terms of purchasing, I think, around 20 homes and refurbishing them, renting them, and housing them, putting some homeowner occupants.
I remember that. And they want to expand into manufacturing, as I understand it,
too. That's correct. I mean, it's a very successful business, and it was going great for a number of years. And in order for that to happen, we as a city had to pass a special land use permit. It's a permit that allows them to put uses on that property that normally don't fit under the current zoning. And there are very specific conditions that have to be met in order for that to happen. For example, the use cannot change the essential character of the surrounding neighborhood, and it has to be keeping with the natural environment of the lot, and it has to protect and preserve the residential neighborhood and not have negative impact on the quality of life for the residents. Doesn't meet any of those conditions. And so the initial concern that the council had was, hey, wait a minute, how did we get here in the first place? Because a number of us were challenging the idea that this did in fact meet those conditions and that the city went ahead and issued the building permit and allowed it to move forward. So there is some concern there. We are looking at that as part of a number of things that we're looking at. So as we move forward, how can we prevent this from happening again? And we're looking at ordinance changes to make sure that these issues would actually come back before council, actually have public hearings and a vote, so things like this can't happen again. We're looking at the personal property exemption that was requested. In fact, Niwave took that off the table for a while, and we directed Niwave to sit down with the neighborhood and to please work out a resolution, and that's what's been ongoing. It's, I think, clear to us at this point on council that those negotiations are about as far as they can go. So we're going to be taking up the personal property exemption. We're going to be taking up the ordinance change. We want to start working and pushing that forward. It looks like, because of the scheduling and everything that's involved, that will all probably come to an head near the end of March. We want to get this done before our budget begins. The other piece that we're looking at, and this was brought to us by the neighborhood, is that they want us, through our city attorney's office, to do a very clear review of the SLU as it applies to this new building. We have in the SLU permit a clawback provision that says if the conditions are not met, we can take the SLU back, and there are some changes and things that we can do there as well. So those are all the things that we have on our plate at this time that we're going to be dealing with tomorrow and start the process for to come.
That's a lot on your plate.
It is.
Did a city department drop the ball here?
Well, the city department had to make a review and make it determined that, in fact, it did meet all the conditions, and as a result of that, they went ahead and issued the building permit. In my opinion, I think they did drop the ball, and I think the city, in that regard, bears some responsibility in terms of the resolution of this issue. You have NIAWAVE stepping up with $100,000 for some landscaping. It's now up to, I think, city council to take a look. What is the responsibility of the city here? Look, Mark, you know, we sit here and say and give a lot of lip service to neighborhoods and how we support neighborhoods, and we're putting some really serious economic development issues within these neighborhoods, and we want to support economic development. So we have a responsibility that when we do that, we're not going to create a situation that we have here where it is clear, there is no doubt in my mind, that property values have been negatively affected, that quality of life of the people that live around this have been negatively affected. And that's done in part by decisions that the city made that, in my view, again, I'm just one council member, that I don't think met the requirements and the conditions of the SLU. So I think we do bear some responsibility on that, and we're going to be talking about that in committee as well.
Is it clear to you where this bureaucratic breakdown likely took place?
I don't know if it's a breakdown. The process, I mean, you know, we can sit here and beat up NIAWAVE, but NIAWAVE did what any business would do. They put a business plan together. They brought it to the city. They said, this is our budget. This is what we want to do. The city was the backstop. The city was the safety net. They reviewed it. They made the approvals. They gave the building permit, and NIAWAVE went ahead and built it.
Did something get rubber stamped that shouldn't have been rubber stamped?
No, I think it was reviewed. I just think the wrong decisions were made.
Okay. Will you decide tomorrow the outcome of the personal property exemption? Will that be determined as early as tomorrow?
No, we will. What will have to happen is we're going to have to set this for a public hearing, which I think will occur on or about the end of February. And then once the public hearing occurs, it'll be referred back to committee, and then a final decision will be made at that time.
I'd like to get, Mary Elaine, you've already weighed in on this, but in your opinion, Brian, is NIAWAVE's lack of participation an effort to wear the group down and eliminate some items from their ask list?
Well, I think it's been disappointing in terms of their presence at these meetings. I mean, there's a way that these things can get worked out. I appreciate at least the effort and the expenditure. $100,000 is $100,000, but it's not going as far as I would like to see in terms of remedying the issue. I would like to see them, though, at these meetings. They do send representatives. Sometimes they don't appear at all. And it's been, I think, somewhat problematic in terms of trying to get this issue resolved.
Let's be clear here. Are you saying that the landscaping plan that they put on the table would have cost the company $100,000?
That's what is being proposed at this time.
What's the total cost of your list of asks, Mary Elaine? Has that been calculated?
I know when some of it is simply tearing up a fence, tearing down a sign, so minimal expense.
Well, planting the, mature trees,
right.
There's got to be a cost to that.
Right, and that's when we met with them and they presented the plan, they had said to us in that meeting that it could run anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000, roughly the equivalent of their tax abatement request is what we were told, some of their guesstimates. But it also wasn't clear to us with the accountability issues whether they were going to continue to work with Bob Ford for the implementation of the project or if they were going to kind of outsource it to Home Depot.
Well, I think, you know, the concern that we keep hearing, and Mary Elaine has been in the forefront on this, is that you know, it's not just the landscaping. The facade of this building, what should have happened was when you look at the SLU and the conditions that were required, any building on that property should have matched the same architecture of the school that's there, that's brick and mortar. And I think the major discussions that we've had is how do we change the facade on that building? And that's where the costs really come in. And, I mean, there's a couple hundred thousand that have been kicked around. And so I think that's, you know, what we've been hearing a lot from the neighborhood is how can this become somewhat invisible in the sense of matching up with what is currently there.
In your role as chairman of the Planning and Development Committee, Brian Jeffries, have you had any contact with the company that you could share with us here? Are you getting any signals, any signs from them?
Oh, sure. I've had a number of meetings with them. We've talked through a lot of things. I've expressed my opinions to them, the same that I've said here today. I've encouraged them to attend these meetings, you know, and I've met also with the neighborhood on a number of times as well, trying to, you know, get this thing, get the parties together and work it out. I mean, really what should have happened on this, Mark, and what the frustrating thing about this is, particularly as a council member, is council's been handed a hot potato here that, you know, had the process worked, had we had the neighborhood in before the permits were issued, had this discussion occurred before the building was built, I think we could have worked out something that would have been accommodating to both parties and we wouldn't be in the position we are here today. And that's the intent and the purpose behind the ordinance that we're proposing, the ordinance changes, that so that in the future, we're not going to have this, that we're going to force that conversation to occur before any build-out occurs on any of these other projects that are located in the city of Lansing. It's unusual. This project, I've been on council since in 12 years, and this is the first time I've seen anything like this. It's a very rare occurrence, but we certainly cannot afford to have this happen again in the city.
How do you expect the public hearings to go? Do you expect, just a landslide of support for the neighborhood here, or will it be more complicated than that?
That's what's been consistent so far. I mean, we've had, this issue is not something that we had it 6 months ago and it's disappeared. I mean, we've had folks down almost every Monday night when we meet as a city council to come and just speak on the issue, even though it's not even on the agenda. So this is an issue that resonates not only in the community, and Mark, I think what's important is that, you know, this issue, unlike any other issue that I've seen, has resonated throughout the city. We have received letters of support from the East Side Neighborhood Organization, which is located on the east side of the neighborhood, or east side of the city, from Old Everett down in southeast part of the city, Colonial Village. All the neighborhoods are worried about this and concerned about this because they don't want it happening in their neighborhood. So we have to respond to it.
We've got less than a minute to go. Carol Wood announced on Current State last week she will not be running for mayor. Any response to that? Disappointed or?
Well, I talked to Carol, and I knew she was leaning that way. I mean, she, as president, and now she's chair of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, has a lot on her table or on her plate, and I think really wants to commit the time to do that, and I can understand her decision.
You're not running? You are running?
What is this? I mean, you keep pulling this out of people. I've given it a lot of thought, and I've had a lot of people push me in that direction. But at this time, I'm going to stick with city council. I'm up this year, and that's what I'm going to continue to do.
Thanks very much for joining us. City Councilman Brian Jeffries, Mary Elaine Keener of the Fix the Facade Group in the Walnut neighborhood in Lansing. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The Michigan State University Department of Theater will stage 8 performances of a new play called UP starting tonight. UP was written by Michigan natives Mark Colson and Peter Mervis, and WKAR Scott Pohl attended a rehearsal last week to learn more about the show.
Big Mac. All big. I used to go up there whenever I had the chance. This bridge is something to see.
UP is the story of a man who's disillusioned with his life in Los Angeles, who sets off on a road trip to get his head together. The trip ultimately leads him to Michigan's Upper Peninsula and the roots he never knew he had. Charlotte native Mark Colson and collaborator Peter Mervis, who grew up in Howell, wrote the story as a screenplay 10 years ago. But Hollywood types didn't get the whole Upper Peninsula thing. Colson has converted UP for the stage, and MSU encouraged him to put the show on this season. He says its cinematic origins are reflected in this multimedia presentation, with film shot across the country.
I spent a couple of days in Los Angeles shooting, and then a friend of mine and I got into a car and drove across the country, right? And so we're hitting, you know, amazing stuff, especially in the West, right? Driving, you know, but I think we were on Highway 40 for a bit of time, and then we got off on two-lane highways, Monument Valley, many locations in Colorado, Durango. It was a fantastic trip, and so we have some really interesting footage.
Colson spent 20 years acting in Los Angeles with credits on shows like Mad Men, Bones, and Parks and Recreation. He's been on the MSU Theater Department faculty for about a year and a half. In this scene from UP, the lead character, John, holds a Mackinac Bridge snow globe as the specter of his grandfather reminds him of his roots.
Yeah, the Upper Peninsula. It's paradise up there. Lots of woods and no people. My kind of place. The gateway to that whole thing is that bridge.
The Mackinac Bridge.
Well, what right. In the hell else would Big Mac be? It's your snow dome. What did you think it was? You're telling me that you picked that thing up, have been carrying it around for days, and didn't even know what it was? You've been across it a bunch of times. Heck, I know all about it.
That's Kirill Shainerman in the role of the mystical grandfather, Forrest. Adam Sutherland has the lead role of John.
What John goes through is something that I feel like everybody goes through. He's an easily relatable character, and it's just something's not clicking in his life, and he's missing like a piece of himself. So what he does is he goes and searches for it, basically. He tries to find his roots. And that basically leads him to a certain brink that may push him to where he never thought possible.
Sutherland compares UP to The Wizard of Oz, a road trip with stops along the way.
It's like Dorothy and how she comes up with the Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Lion. And I meet people, including characters like Mary, Letitia, and Gilbert, who all change me and listen to me, listen to what I have to say. And for John, that's very crucial because in his life in L.A., nobody really cared what he had to say. So it's a breath of fresh air coming and talking with these characters because they actually have open ears and care what he has to say.
Another character John encounters is Sharon, a waitress who's a real youper. Kara O'Connor is playing her.
She's very friendly, and she takes an interest in John because she lives in a small town where she's probably known every guy since she was 2 years old. And so she sees someone new, and he's attractive, and so she asks him to come to the VFW later. Hey, this will be fun kind of thing. So it's a fun scene. I really enjoy it.
A play about the Upper Peninsula is bound to be compared to Escanaba Into Moonlight, arguably the most popular Michigan-based play in the last few decades. Writer and director Mark Colson says his show isn't a broad comedy like the Jeff Daniels play.
I think there are laughs in it, right? But also, too, I think that the subject matter as far as someone, you know, truly being lost, losing their identity, losing connection with themselves, right, and trying to, you know, and looking for answers and then ultimately finding themselves, I think they're really two different things.
Though it started as a screenplay and has been adapted for the stage, Colson is still harboring hopes of putting UP on film.
We went down to Michigan Motion Picture Studios, and we shot green screen down there. And so everybody's pretty well on board. We're establishing relationships with Michigan Motion Picture Studios. Also, too, the dean of the college is really interested in possibly pursuing this idea of film as well. So we really sort of feel like we have a lot of people in our corner. This is the first step, and I believe that we are going to take it to the next step.
The MSU Department of Theater production of UP has performances tonight through Sunday in the RCAH Auditorium inside Snyder Phillips Hall on the MSU campus. Showtime this evening is 7:30. There's some adult language in the play, so parents should consider whether or not to bring children. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And stick around, the second half of our program is coming up. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Welcome back to Current State. Here on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. State Rep. Andy Shore joins us on the show tomorrow. I'll drop that in right now. There was some good news last week in Michigan regarding foreclosure fraud. On Thursday, officials announced the state will receive $2.5 million. That's the settlement in a mortgage fraud lawsuit filed last year by State Attorney General Bill Schuette. The suit involved about 1,000 victims of robo-signing statewide, but about 300 of them, 30% of them, were just from Ingham County alone. And Register of Deeds Curtis Hertel Jr. brought those 300 to the AG's attention, as I understand it. And Curtis Hertel joins us now in Current State. How are you?
Good, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Am I right? Did you bring those 300 to Attorney General Schuette's attention?
We found 300 examples of what we thought were pretty obvious forgeries in documents that have been filed in Ingham County. We then brought registers from around the state together, and we met with the Attorney General and the FBI right in my office. So we brought 20 different registers from around the state, brought in different examples of these documents, and I think they took the 1,000 best of those examples and used those in the lawsuit. But the reality is, these signatures were used in hundreds of thousands of documents across the country in people's foreclosures.
But the fact that 300 of the 1,000 were from Ingham County, was this that? What should people read into that? Was this kind, was robo-signing more prevalent in Ingham County than in other counties? It was just that,
absolutely what? Not. We just brought it to them first.
Okay. Well, congratulations are in order, I guess. You must feel good about this.
I'm glad that we've gotten attention to it. I think that this is important. I think that the reality is there's been a lot of pain throughout the foreclosure process on a number of people, and that due processes should be followed, and they haven't been. I think this shows that the foreclosure process is broken in Michigan, that we need to change the laws. It's a start. I don't want to say that this is the end of what I want to happen. I think it just shows a pattern of abuse by the major banks against individual citizens, and we need to do everything we can to make sure that they play by the rules. And if you and I used illegal documents to take someone's home, we'd go to jail. And unfortunately, at this point, we haven't seen anyone go to jail in this process, and we need to change that. We need to change Michigan law to assure this never happens again and punish those that are responsible.
This involved a Georgia-based mortgage processor named Doc X. Remind us again how Doc X ran afoul of the law.
Yeah, Doc X was assigned for recreating documents that were lost in the foreclosure process. They were lost because the banks decided to stop filing these documents in offices like mine around the country, save a little money. And so they created their own shadow registry system called MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. When they went to go foreclose, they had to have these documents, but they were either lost, stolen, never created. We don't know the answer to that question. But at that point, they hired this company called DocX. Now, DocX didn't have any bank vice presidents that worked for them that would be signing these actual mortgages. They didn't have anybody who was qualified to review bank documents to make sure that they were being done legally. Instead, what they did was they hired people $12 an hour to sit in a room and pass papers back and forth and sign signatures as bank vice presidents. Worse than that, they decided that it would be easier if it wasn't the actual people signing, because it was an easier fraud that way. So they picked a woman who worked in the mailroom department, who was also not a bank vice president, named Linda Green. And they picked her because her name was easy to spell. And literally, her signature is on hundreds of thousands of documents across the country, transferring ownership of people's mortgages and allowing for a quicker foreclosure. And so really, it's a forgery of a fraud. She's not a bank vice president. The person signing is not a bank vice president. And on top of that, she's not signing the documents.
A forgery of a fraud.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, it's
a crime on top of a crime.
It's interesting that they would choose to forgerize the fraud, because I guess it was harder to track that way. And Linda Green's not the only one. She's the most famous because she went on 60 Minutes and admitted that she never signed any documents. But there's another woman named Tawana Thomas who signs both left and right-handed. I mean, they're not that complicated of a fraud. The problem is that all these documents go out into thousands of registered deeds across the country. And so they were like needles in haystacks. So if you knew what you were looking for, and once we found a pattern, we knew what we were looking for, they were relatively easy to find. But it took a lot of investigation. It actually was a woman named Lynn Smysloniak, who actually found these. She was a fraud investigator who trained FBI agents, and she was going through foreclosure and could not understand how she couldn't find out who actually owned her mortgage. And what she basically did was looked at all the signatures and looked for patterns and found this amazing fraud.
And so they finally chose to foreclose on the wrong person.
Exactly.
Basically what it boils down to. Okay.
They found the one person who could actually was trained to actually see this fraud. And once she was able to do that, we started getting registers from around the country to get interested in this issue.
How this hasn't become a movie is beyond me. Isn't this a rich movie script waiting to happen?
I think it certainly could be. I mean, the reality is that, especially in Michigan, we have the easiest state in the country to foreclose. We have zero checks and balances in our system. We have what's called foreclosure by advertisement, which means someone can take your house without ever having to go to a judge, ever have to prove to a government official that there's a real deficiency, never have to prove that you filed the law. It's a very destructive process, and there are few foreclosure firms in the state who have made millions of dollars off this process.
In Michigan.
Absolutely. Really, there are two of the biggest firms, Orleans and Trot and Trot, and they've made millions of dollars off of this. And, you know, I think it's a machine that feeds off of human misery. And that really we need to slow down the process and make sure that, I mean, if someone's going to take your most important asset, they should have to prove three things. There's a real deficiency, that they follow the law, and that they're the ones that should be able to take the home, that they actually own the deficiency that's being taken. That doesn't happen. And we have a foreclosure fraud hotline in Ingham County. We're the only county in the state that has it. The number, if people are in trouble, is 676-7210. But we created that foreclosure fraud hotline, and we started hearing stories. People would call us up and say things to us, and we would say, well, that just doesn't make any sense. But the next day, someone would call up that exact same story. We have people that we have found in Ingham County that were making payments on modifications and that were still foreclosed. We have people who were told by their bank to stop making payments, that sent paperwork in three and four times, all trying to do the right thing, and it was lost at every step. And while they were told by their bank that, don't worry about it, we're working with you, at the same time they were being dual-tracked and being pushed into foreclosure. Oftentimes the bank doesn't even know which of these properties they own. It's a mess. It's a complete and utter mess.
How do Orleans and Trot respond to their involvement in this? How do they describe it? How do they justify it?
Well, I mean, they would say they're performing a service for the banking industry, and it's been a very lucrative one. And I'm not saying that it hasn't been. I'm saying there's been a lot of corners cut, and that we've proven that foreclosure by advertisement, the system that is currently in this state, assumes that the banks are playing by the rules and are correct in all these practices. I'm pretty sure that this $2.5 million settlement or the other bank settlements that have come down from the AGs proves that that's not the case. They obviously are violating the law in many cases. So if that's the case, then why shouldn't we change that law and make sure that people have due process in the foreclosure process?
How many of these 300 Ingham County robo-signing victims have you come to know? I mean, are you that closely involved with these folks or what?
Well, the 300 are just a base. Unfortunately for most of those people, a large part of them, they'd already lost their homes. They had already been foreclosed by the time anybody saw this crime happening. It's unfortunate, but there's not a lot. No one's gotten their home back after being foreclosed, and I don't think it's going to happen. There's usually a good faith buyer after that. So, we've come to know them and help them through the fraud hotline, but there are plenty of other different frauds that we're dealing with. I mean, the one thing I would say is that the DocX case is the lowest hanging fruit on the tree of this massive fraud. And I'm glad we're going after it, but we need to get higher up in the tree and go after the people that actually made the most money in this process and who really made the decisions that led to us being in this crisis.
Is time running out here? I mean, is this thing, with the passage of time, is this just being forgotten? Actually, it's ironic I should pose that question because I think that question's triggered by something that just happened this morning. The feds are apparently filing suit against one of the ratings agencies here that played a key role in the mortgage meltdown. Is this issue being forgotten?
I hope not. I mean, I certainly am standing up and fighting and trying to keep it on the front of everyone's mind. I mean, the good news is foreclosures are down in the county. The bad news is there's been nothing done by the state or the federal government to really fix the overlying problems. I mean, the biggest issue I have is we've broken down the entire system. On the one end, we've talked about the foreclosures are way too easy to do in the state and we need to have more checks and balances. And I have spoken to the legislature. I've testified in front of the legislature. I've tried to make those changes. On the other end, and this is what we're getting at with the Standard & Poor suit that was announced this morning, we have broken the system down on how people actually get mortgages. The average person buys a mortgage at their local bank. Within 2 or 3 days, it's sold to somebody else. Within a few weeks from that, it's either insured through the federal government or, on the other end, is sold to investors. There used to be a checks and balances so that the person who is giving the loan actually cared that you were going to make payments on the loan, that you could afford to make payments. Instead, we were actually training people to actually get around the underwriting process. We were basically saying to people, you know, you can give loans and sell them the next day. So there was no really incentive to actually have the checks and balances that we had before. It'd be nice to go back to a more simpler time. But I think the biggest thing is, in the 1990s, we actually allowed for lending institutions, banks that were savings and loans, to actually also become investment banks. That had always been outlawed in this country. But we decided somewhere along the line that it was a good idea to allow investment banks and savings and loans banks to be the same thing. I think that has led to terrible decisions being made. That these actually are loans that are supposed to be a trust between you and your bank are now just an investment. You're no longer actually a person who's a customer of that bank. You're a line on a sheet of paper that's going to be sold to somebody else in the open market. And I think that's really a large part of the problem. We should go back to the situations where the bank that is dealing with on a savings and loan can't be selling you as an asset on the open market. And that just seems fair and right. It worked in this country for centuries. And we changed it in the 90s, and I think it's had drastic problems now that we've gotten to the foreclosure crisis.
Was that the Glass-Steagall?
Yes.
Yeah. So Glass-Steagall was revoked in 1994?
Five. Somewhere in there, yeah.
How stern a message? We're talking with Ingham County Register of Deeds, Curtis Hertel, Jr. How stern a message does the $2.5 million settlement send to the mortgage fraud industry, to the mortgage industry?
I think it's good that we're saying, if you use these illegal documents, you'll pay. I think that we have to go further. I think there's still criminal prosecution going on of the head of LPS who ran the DocX Corporation. So there is a criminal investigation going on as well. And I think that's good, and we should see that. I think we should go further. I think we need to look at the foreclosure firms in this state, the ones that are still using these illegal documents to take people's homes. We have people in Ingham County that are still being foreclosed on using documents that we now know are illegal. And the bank and the foreclosure firms in this state argue that we can't actually use defenses, and oftentimes they're winning, that these documents are fraudulent, even though we know they're fraudulent. It's common knowledge they're fraudulent in the industry. In fact, Trot & Trot last year filed one of these documents in my office after everything had come out. And I called them up and said, I will hold recordings for a half hour, but I need you to call and tell me to take this off record. If not, it's my duty to put it on record and I will be calling the Attorney General's office. This is a known fraudulent document. Within 15 minutes, I got a call saying, please, we made a mistake, don't put that on record. But 6 months later, they're still using that those same documents that were already on record to take people's homes.
In other counties?
In this county.
In Ingham County?
In Ingham County.
Okay.
Because I can't stop them from using that those documents in foreclosure. I mean, in all honesty, we have the power to fight them, but we don't have the power to stop the process.
You are a Democrat. I've got to get your take on our new House representation at the state capitol.
Andy Shore or Samson?
Well, Andy's on the show tomorrow, so yeah, we can start with Andy.
Andy's a good friend. We served on the Board of Commissioners together. I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. I think he's a very good leader, and I think he has a long future ahead of him.
Okay.
Sam, the same way. Sam's thing, I think, is brilliant, very hard worker. Tom Cochran is fantastic. I knocked doors for all three of these people in the primary and the general. I'm really happy with who we have.
Okay. Ingham County Register of Deeds Curtis Hertel Jr. on the settlement yesterday involving robo-signing victims here in Ingham County and around the state of Michigan. Many thanks.
Thank you.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Carl Goode is graphics editor in residence at Michigan State University's College of Communication Arts and Sciences. He came to MSU from Newsweek Magazine's New York offices, where he spent over a decade as Newsweek's director of information graphics. Now, information graphics may be familiar to you if you're an avid magazine reader. They are those boxes of facts and dates and charts and photos and other stuff that really bring a story together visually. Carl Goode's work in information graphics is part of an exhibit at the Michigan Historical Museum called Put It on Paper. And WKAR's Peter Wharf caught up with Carl at the exhibit recently to talk about the creative process in information graphics and Goode's work with Newsweek.
I was the director of information graphics, those visual explainers, you know, maps, charts, diagrams, cutaways, everything, you know, at Newsweek magazine for 10 years. You know, there was a staff of 10 people in the department. I was the leader because I was the one most willing to take the fall if something went wrong. But, you know, we were there. I was the one in charge when the World Trade Center was under attack down the street, and we did all the diagrams of the buildings and explaining where the planes were hijacked from and their routes and all that visual stuff. I was never the most talented one in the room or the smartest. I was always the most enthusiastic, though, and I like to think that I helped to bring the team together with all the different skills to tell visual stories. And so that was a wonderful 10-year run at Newsweek, and then academia came calling, and so now I'm at MSU in the Department of Journalism.
Let's look at this infographic that comes from Newsweek magazine. This is a blown-up display here for the purposes of the Put It on Paper exhibit. And this is some of your work from Newsweek magazine that brings together an understanding of a certain time and a certain place in American history, particularly as it relates to Afghanistan.
That's right. You know, there are, you know, there was a lot going on in Afghanistan. There was a lot to explain before we went into Afghanistan. So I was asked if we could explain this particular week how the special forces worked in Afghanistan, how they were going to go in there and what they were going to do when they got in there. And so, when I start a graphic like that, I sketch. I do a lot of drawing and sketching because I generally don't know anything about the subject. It might be physics. It might be business. It might be military. It might be how to plant flowers in a garden so they bloom all day. I don't know anything about that. But I start asking questions as just the layperson about what I don't know, things I'd like to know, questions I have that any curious reader would want to know. And so that helps me to answer those questions.
And who are you asking these questions?
Of myself. Yeah. So that's what this first sketch up here does, the very rough one. It's just all these questions and ideas I have for filling in this graphic And then I was going to see if I could answer those questions with experts.
We're looking at two large sketches, which I assume are in chronological order before the final product of this this infographic. So beginning at the top, this is one of the first sketches. Can mm-hmm. you describe a little sketch. Bit more? The first sketch.
Yeah, there, it's just a pen and ink sketch. And if you look along the top, you'll see a doodle up there because I really lost... I'm ADD and I totally lost track of what I was thinking, or I didn't know what to think next or what question to ask. So doodling helps me relax that part of my brain that wants to be, you know, eating candy and, you know, watching movies, and so I can think with the other side. And so and I know our editor happens to love night revision goggles, you know, big central images. So I immediately just sketched a special forces guy in the middle with big night vision goggles. So I figured that'll probably anchor this thing. Okay. So I'm in a way I'm kind of combining design with content, with questions about the content, questions about the design. So I'm mixing them together like in a pot, like in a stew. I'm sort of, you know, not sure. And then I wrote all these questions around it about things that I'm wondering, like how with a question mark, and overseas, where are these people? Where are they deployed? You know, what do they take with them? What do they do when they're in a country? So what my process for research was always to write a bunch of questions. Some you kind of, most of us know answers to some questions, you know, we like, the internet allows us to do our own research and inform ourselves to a point where now I can't find any more on the internet. I need to go call an expert, but I'm informed enough now to not sound like a moron when I'm talking to an admiral or a general, so, or whatever, a PR guy at the Department of Defense.
You have your foot in the door informationally.
I have my foot in the door informationally, and you don't want to waste this very precious time you finally get with this person who's going to answer some very important questions with dumb questions that you could have answered on the internet, like what is a tank, you know,
right.
You know, but people do that, right. You know, so what is a tank anyway? Did you even like read anything about what I do here?
So that's sort of the initial sketch. Now we're in phase two.
Then I did a more polished sketch that started to draw. You know, I'm an artist, so I could. But you know, you can still sketch without being an artist. You can still sketch out a concept. Like my wife always beats me at Pictionary because if the challenge is to draw a horse, I'll
quickly,
right. And whoever answers the question, it's like charades.
Right.
I'll be so wrapped up in the details of what a horse looks like, the nostril and the mane, and trying to show off that I can draw a horse.
Right.
She'll draw a wedge with a point on top and her and horse, you know.
Right.
So you don't need to be able to draw well. It just has to communicate an idea. So when you're doing a sketch like this. So this is a more polished sketch, you know, more finished, and...
It's starting to take shape here with this central figure of the soldier holding the weapon. That's going to eventually lead to the largest image.
Coming.
And the helicopters.
And the different equipment they're going to use there with helicopters and doom buggies and, you know, Stinger missiles and all that. Well, defenses against Stinger missiles on the ground, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Maps, world map, where they're deployed. All the things that I found interesting as a person.
And then what do you hope to achieve in the final product?
Well, the number one thing you hope to achieve is not making a mistake with the content. And we've made mistakes, you know. They say that journalism is history written on the fly. And, you know, you bang this stuff out and you hope you didn't make a mistake. You do the best you can to minimize those errors. So I want it to be right. The second thing I want it to be is clear so that the reader feels like they can easily move through the information without, you know, being all crazy and scary. And then when they're there, you want them to have a great ride and feel like they walked away with something, like they feel smarter. For people that love info, it's like what Wired magazine calls their info porn. You know, it's like people are just, they love stuff like this. They eat it up. I'm no expert on anything. The reason I worked well for Newsweek was I was pretty in touch. I was a pretty average person. I was pretty in touch with the average reader's curiosity about anything. So I just tried to answer the questions, my own questions.
Carl Goode is graphic editor in residence at Michigan State University's College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences. Carl, thanks so much for the tour.
Oh, this was fun. Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And Current State has learned that the battle for the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party is broken open. Michigan's entire Democratic congressional delegation has endorsed Lon Johnson to replace 18-year leader Mark Brewer. That's a fight that pits unions and party leaders against each other over the future strategy of Democrats in Michigan. As we mentioned earlier, tomorrow's show,
House Representative Andy Shore. Also, coming up later in the week, John Nixon, State Budget Director. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com.